From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Well, I heard the news. That's good to rockin' tonight. Well, I heard the
news. On today's Fresh Air, the life of Elvis Presley. We talk with Peter Guralnick. He's just completed volume one of his two-part biography of Elvis. Also, our linguist Jeffrey Nunberg listens to my fellow broadcasters. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
I say, oh, meet me in a hurry behind the barn. Don't you be afraid, I'll do you no harm. I want you to bring along my rocking shoes, cause tonight I'm going to rock away all the blues. I heard the news, there's good to rockin' tonight.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide says he'll return to Haiti in 11 days. He told the United Nations General Assembly in the last hour that on his return, he'll celebrate a festival of reconciliation, peace, and democracy. The current ruling Haitian junta leaders must first leave before he resumes power, and one of the leaders of Haiti's military regime has stepped down and left the country. NPR Suni Khalid reports from Port-au-Prince.
Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Michel Francois crossed the border into the Dominican Republic earlier today following his resignation as head of the Haitian police. American Embassy spokesman Stanley Schrager said Michel Francois had attempted to cross the border last night but was forced to wait until he received permission from Dominican authorities to enter the country. Michel Francois, viewed by many as the most brutal of Haiti's three military rulers, owns a home in the Dominican capital, Santo Domingo, where he sent his family weeks ago. Schrager called the departure of Michel Francois a good step toward restoring Haiti's democracy. 3 years ago, Michel Francois joined Haitian military leaders Lieutenant General Raoul Cedras and Brigadier General Philippe Biambi in launching the military coup that toppled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The resignation of all three men is a precondition of agreements intended to restore democracy to Haiti. I'm Suni Khalid in Port-au-Prince.
A strong earthquake registering at least 7.9 on the Richter scale rocked northern Japan today. At least one person has died and scores are injured. Most of the injuries are not serious. Tidal wave warnings have been issued for hundreds of Pacific islands from the Northern Marianas to Hawaii and Alaska. Residents of Guam have been awakened and told to move to higher ground. Drew Hodwall reports.
The tsunami warning came during the early morning hours, just moments after the quake rocked the Japanese coast. Guam is situated roughly 1,200 miles southeast of Japan. It's among the first islands in the Micronesian and Marshall Island chains to be affected by any kind of seismic tidal activity. Police began evacuating low-lying areas in the villages of Tumon and Agat. Both villages face the Philippine Sea. Police say the evacuations went smoothly as sleepy villagers were rustled from their beds and told to move to higher ground. The Civil Defense Agency says the apparent danger is now past, but they're asking all people and tourists to stay out of the waters as the danger of aftershocks could be present throughout most of the day. For National Public Radio, I'm Drew Hadwall in Guam.
A federal judge in Florida says anti-abortion activist Paul Hill won't be able to use the defense of justifiable homicide in his murder trial. Hill is accused of killing an abortion clinic doctor and his escort in July. His lawyer had argued for the claim because Hill had been unable to stop abortions by any other legal means. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials have fallen 52 points. This is NPR. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says the United States will lift trade sanctions on China because of its alleged transfers of missile technology to Pakistan. Christopher says in exchange, China won't export the missiles, which can send a 1,000-pound payload 186 miles away. The sanctions had been imposed when Washington found out that Beijing had sent Pakistan the material and information. This violated a global missile treaty. China has never confirmed doing this. Some Russians returning to their country from India are refusing to submit to a 6-day quarantine. The Russian government ordered the medical detention because of the plague outbreak in India. NPR's Ann Gerrels reports.
When a charter plane arrived in the Ural city of Perm, 750 miles from Moscow, many passengers refused to get off. Like many here, these Russians had traveled to India in search of cheap goods, which they planned to resell at home for a profit. According to a Russian news agency, these passengers feared their luggage would be destroyed under the quarantine restrictions. After sitting on the ground for almost 24 hours without food and in an unheated aircraft, the passengers have finally told authorities they will leave, but only if their purchases are stored in a safe room. Like Russia, Ukraine has also instituted quarantine restrictions against plague. Both countries are already trying to cope with epidemics of cholera and diphtheria. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Contract talks between the National Hockey League and the Players Union have resumed in New York. Negotiations began about 4 hours ago. This is the first face-to-face meeting between both sides in almost a week. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman and union head Bob Gudineau talked by phone 2 days ago, but their discussion hasn't been made public. Bettman put off the start of the season last Friday when he said games wouldn't be played before October 15th. So far, 16 games have been put off and 4 have been scheduled for tonight. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's no shortage of books about Elvis Presley, but the new book, Last Train to Memphis, may be the definitive story of his early years. It's the first in a projected 2-volume biography of Elvis, written by Peter Guralnick, the author of previous books about the blues, country music, and Southern soul music. Guralnick says he wants to rescue Elvis from his detractors, his admirers, and the dreary bondage of myth. Let's start with Elvis's very first recording. When he was 18, he went to the fledgling Sun Studio in Memphis, run by Sam Phillips, to take advantage of their service that let you make your own record for $3.98 plus tax.
I think what he had in mind when he went down to the Memphis Recording Service at 706 Union Avenue, what he had in mind, in the back of his mind, in a vague sort of way, was that he wanted to be discovered, and this was the only way he knew to try out for a label which had become increasingly prominent over the last few months. They had had a huge hit recently with the Prisoners just walking in the rain. There had been a big article in the newspaper about Sun Records, this brand new label at the Memphis Recording Service, which was where you could go in and make your own record, about Sam Phillips, about his search for new talent. And it's hard to believe that in some way this didn't filter down to Elvis. And when he went in there, I think it was very much in his mind, I want to be discovered. And he was somebody who lacked the sophistication to know, how do you get discovered? I mean, he wasn't, it's kind of like, Lana Turner being discovered or something. But I think he went in there and he sang, he sang a song that he had sung over and over again in privately at parties and this sort of thing. And I think he saw it as his best song, and somehow or other he was hoping that the owner of the studio, Sam Phillips, would tap him on the shoulder and say, son, I want to make records with you.
Tell us about the song and what he sounded like when he performed it.
The first song, I think the principal song that he went to record, was My Happiness, which was really a song, just a sentimental ballad. The thing that's astonishing about it, if you listen to it today, is that as unformed as his style is and as uncertain as his phrasing may be and as rudimentary as his guitar accompaniment is, Elvis is all there, and you can hear it. You can hear the almost... There's something being communicated. You can hear the ache. You can hear the yearning. You can hear the vulnerability in his voice. What you can't hear the remotest trace of is what came to be known as rock and roll. You can't hear anything like the black influence, because there just isn't any, not in this presentation. And what's remarkable, I guess, in a way, is that he and Sam Phillips ever got to the point where they came, ever got to the point where they hit upon what came to be known as rock and roll.
Well, let me play My Happiness so we could hear the first record Elvis Presley ever made.
Okay, great.
Evening shadows make me blue. When each weary day is through, how I long to be with you. My happiness, every day I reminisce, dreaming of your tender kiss. kiss, always thinking how I miss my happiness. Years it seems have gone by since we shared our dreams, but I hold you again. There'll be no blue memories then, where the skies are gray.
My guest is Peter Guralnick, the author of the new biography of Elvis Presley, The Last Train to Memphis. Elvis recorded this hoping that it would give him an in at Sun Records. He wanted this to be his audition. So what did Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records, have to say when he heard what Elvis had done?
Pretty much nothing. Not at that time. I mean, I think on Elvis's part it was an unrealistic hope. And what he got out of it ultimately was he got a two-sided acetate. The other side was That's When My Heartaches Begin. And he went home with it and he played it himself. His parents played it. I'm sure everyone marveled at it. He played it for his friends, and he stored it away eventually. What this probably led to was a revamping of his thinking, and all through the fall of 53, he continued, at least as Marion Kiesker remembers it, and Marion Kiesker was Sam Phillips's assistant, the office manager at Sun Records. And Marion recalls him coming in over the fall, and Sam also has memories of Elvis over the succeeding months. He came back in again in January of 54, made another acetate, and again nothing happened. And it wasn't until the spring of 54, I think until May of 54, that he finally got a call from Sam Phillips. And this came about as a result of both Marion Kiesker and Sam Phillips noting about Elvis, that he was a good ballad singer and that maybe someday, and I'm sure this was also promoted by Elvis's return visits to the studio just to check in, see what was going on, but each of them had noted that Elvis was a good ballad singer. And eventually he got a ballad called Without You, which he had picked up at the Tennessee State Prison over in Nashville. He didn't have a singer for it, and he called Elvis back in.
And so Elvis comes in because Phillips thinks that he has the right voice to record this ballad, and then Phillips doesn't like the way Elvis sings it.
That's right. And again, the interesting thing in terms of this whole issue of cultural theft is that the ballad that he recorded does not resemble in the least anything to do with black music, the African-American tradition. It may very well be a black singer who is singing it, but it could as easily be Dennis Day as the Ink Spots. And Elvis's attempts at it haven't been preserved, at least not as far as anyone knows. But it was obvious that they didn't get anywhere with this ballad. Sam evidently asked Elvis to try other songs. Elvis probably threw in every song he knew, which were mostly, but what he sang for Sam that day was almost entirely ballads. It would be Dean Martin's songs by Dean Martin, songs by Billy Eckstein, songs by the Ink Spots, but nothing whatsoever resembling rock and roll. And I think at the end of the day, there was a feeling of great frustration on Elvis's part. I mean, just terrible disappointment. And on Sam's part, there remained the kernel of the idea that this kid is different. He has a different sound. There may be something. What is there? You know, there's something there that can be gotten. And out of that, Sam put him together with Scotty Moore and Bill Black, and said, "Why don't you guys try something with him and see what happens?"
Scotty Moore, the guitarist, and Bill Black, the bass player.
That's right. Yeah.
So the three of them come back into the studio. And they ended up, instead of doing more ballads, they end up putting out a single that on one side has Blue Moon of Kentucky, which was a Bill Monroe tune, something out of bluegrass, and on the other side had That's All Right, a kind of rhythm and blues thing by Arthur Crudup. How did they end up with that selection, considering Elvis had been pegged as a ballad singer?
I think nobody was more surprised than Sam Phillips, Scotty Moore, or Bill Black. I mean, they came to this out of sheer desperation, I think, on Elvis's part. Elvis met Scotty. He went over to Scotty Moore's house on a Sunday, Sunday, July 4th, as far as I can determine. On Monday night, they went into the studio. They really just ran through a bunch of songs. They ran through the same kinds of songs that Elvis had done for Sam Phillips in the studio previously. On Monday night, they went into the studio, and you can hear some of the early attempts, like Harbor Lights or I'll Love You I Love You Because, which were just pure ballads. Eventually, they were brought out years later by RCA. But it was evident by everyone's account that the session was completely falling apart. They were no more on the verge of success than Elvis had been in his initial tryout. And they took a break, and I think it was just in a moment of sheer desperation that Elvis, everybody's drinking Cokes, and all of a sudden Elvis just starts flailing away on the guitar and singing That's All Right, Mama. When Elvis started playing That's All Right, Scotty and Bill fell in and started playing along, and I'm sure it was very ragged, but Sam Phillips opened up the control room door, and he said, what are you guys doing? And they said, I don't know. And Sam said, well, whatever it is, let's back up and do it again.
Well, let's hear Elvis doing That's All Right.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right. Told me, Papa done told me too. Son, that gal you fooling with, she ain't no good to you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway, do.
It's Elvis Presley. My guest is Peter Guralnick, and his first of a two-part biography of Elvis Presley has just been released. It's called Last Train to Memphis. I guess you really have to give Sam Phillips credit for hearing what it was that made Elvis Elvis and not trying to fashion him into, you know, somebody else's mold.
I think you have to give Sam Phillips enormous credit, not only for hearing, which is unique enough in itself, but for waiting.
Right,
For not imposing himself on Elvis or on Elvis's style. This is really at least a two-tiered story, and probably more, because I think that Scotty and Bill had a great deal to contribute as well. But the thing is that Elvis was a person of such broad musical intelligence. He was someone of so many different musical interests. Marion Kiesker described how, on the first acetate, he went through 12 different styles in the course of one song. And I think you can hear him straining on some of the ballads that came out from those sun years. You just hear all these different voices and all these different gropings, in a sense, towards his own style. It was with That's All Right and Blue Moon of Kentucky, and then rolling on from there, you can hear someone discovering his own voice instantly. It's almost as if it came to him instantly, and it was his voice. It was not the voice that Sam Phillips, there was no imposition in it. Mm-hmm. It was not Sam Phillips saying, hey, you should record a blues, but it was Sam Phillips waiting until that moment happened and then saying, that's it.
My guest is Peter Guralnick, the author of a new biography of Elvis. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Guralnick, the author of Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley. In your book, you really treat Sam Phillips with enormous respect.
Yeah, I think it's one of those remarkable accidents of history that a person of such unique talent as Elvis should be thrown in with a person of such equally unique gifts as Sam Phillips. I mean, you have really the meeting in Sam Phillips, you have someone who's as close to a genius as anyone I've ever met, and you have his a person of just unswerving vision and dedication to the music. What's also interesting about the Elvis Presley story is that when Colonel Parker comes into the story, you have a person of an entirely different kind of genius, but you have someone who, in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of marketing, in terms of is as focused, as driven, and as single-minded as Sam Phillips was with respect to the music, and you had an enormous conflict.
Colonel Tom Parker had already entered the record world by the time he took over Elvis's contract. What did he see in Elvis? What did he want Elvis for?
I think he saw him as a phenomenon that was happening. He witnessed it. He set up a tour early in 55, and he saw the phenomenon happening on that tour. He saw Elvis taking the show from his star act, Hank Snow, whom he was managing exclusively and with whom he was in a booking agency partnership. He saw the thing building. And just as Sam Phillips had recognized the potential in terms of music, just as Sam Phillips had recognized the musical potential, Tom Parker recognized not just the sales potential, but the phenomenological potential. I mean, this thing was happening in a way that nothing had happened before, and it was happening with a speed that nothing had ever happened before, at least not in his experience and not in most people's experience. So from late spring of 55, he was clearly in the picture in terms of trying to wrest the management contract from Bob Neal and get the recording contract from Sam Phillips.
When Parker brought Elvis to RCA, how did that change his sound?
It changed his sound a great deal, only because nobody at RCA knew how to record him. The Colonel had no interest in music. I don't mean to say he had no interest in music. I think he was a passionate advocate of Elvis in every way. And if Elvis had recorded in Lithuanian, the Colonel would have sought the best way to record Lithuanian language records. But it's a mistake to see him as influencing Elvis's sound per se. What really influenced Elvis's sound was that Sam Phillips had evolved a method, and he had also worked out a way of pushing Elvis, not pushing is perhaps the wrong word, but of either inspiring Elvis or creating a climate in which Elvis could find his own voice and find his own style. At RCA, Steve Scholes was the person who essentially signed Elvis to RCA. Steve Scholes was almost he was a person who noted down the times. He was an A&R person. He suggested songs, but most of the songs he suggested Elvis found inappropriate. And he didn't have either a great deal creatively to contribute to Elvis, nor did he know Elvis, which was a very important point for somebody who sought reassurance. I mean, Elvis sought reassurance. He was looking for some form of approbation, and Steve Scholes didn't have it to give.
Peter, I'd like you to choose one of the RCA sessions that Elvis recorded that you think shows something about what changed for him at RCA when Sam Phillips wasn't around to help Elvis keep discovering his Elvisness.
I think a good example, and it doesn't have anything to do with the technical side, is his recording of Blue Suede Shoes. I'm sure that the reason that he recorded it was because it was such a huge hit for Carl Perkins. RCA was nervous that they had signed the wrong artist by getting Elvis rather than Carl, and probably this was Steve Scholes' idea. But the thing is, if you listen to the recording that Elvis did, which I loved at the time and continue to love, it never gets the groove. He never gets past the point. It's taken too fast. It's evident, as Elvis later said, that he simply didn't feel that he could beat Carl Perkins' version. But more than that, it just never grooves in on that inner that you listen, for example, on the Million Dollar Quartet, and you hear him talking about Jackie Wilson's version of "Don't Be Cruel," and he sings it over and over and over and over again. And I think that's how he heard a song, was just by he would hone in on it. And with Blue Suede Shoes, it stopped several steps too short.
Why don't we hear Blue Suede Shoes?
Great.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Let's go, cat!
My guest is Peter Guralnick, and he's a new biography of Elvis Presley. Last Train to Memphis has just been published. It's the first of his two-part biography of Elvis. When Elvis started producing himself at RCA after his early sessions there, what changed for him?
What changed, I think, was that he was driving the session. It was at the July 2nd, 1956 session that produced Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel that he really took over the reins for the first time altogether. And the thing was that I think that it was at this point that he was given directions, may be the wrong word, but he was leading the musicians. He was suggesting where he wanted to go. He was suggesting voicings. He was saying, when Steve Scholes said at the end of Take 18 or something that, I think we've got it now, Elvis said, no, let's keep going, and he went on for 31 takes. He allowed his own artistic vision to take precedence for the first time, and essentially, here he was at 21, he was running his own sessions.
Why don't we listen to Don't Be Cruel?
Okay.
You think this is a good record for him?
I think that for the first time he was, for the first time at RCA, he was singing in his own voice. I think that it's very different than the Sun records he made. It's much more of a pop record. But this was the direction in which he had been looking to evolve from the moment he first stepped into a studio. So that while it may not be as much to my taste as Mystery Train, say, it's a moment in which he's discovered his own Elvis voice once again.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other. Don't stop thinking of me. Don't make me feel this way. Come on over here and love me. You know what I want you to say. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Why should we be apart? I really love you, baby. Cross my heart. Let's walk up to the preacher and let's say I do. Then you'll know you'll have me, and I know that I'll have you. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Oh, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't be cruel.
Peter Guralnick is the author of Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley. We'll talk more about Elvis in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Swing. You should have heard this knocked out jailbird sing. Let rock. Everybody let rock.
Coming up, the phenomenon of Elvis Presley. We continue our conversation with Peter Guralnik about the young Elvis Presley and the celebrity status that began to entrap him. Also, we broadcasters like to pronounce foreign words correctly, but is there such a thing as going too far? Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to the radio. That's coming up on Fresh Air. Everybody let's roll.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is defending the U.S. operation in Haiti. General John Shalikashvili says the U.S. presence there has brought significant progress. He says the forces are helping to provide greater stability and that an elected president is poised to retake power. But he says the U.S. is not expanding its role in Haiti. Shalikashvili says the number of American troops will reach 16,500 soon and will fall to no more than 6,000 once international peacekeepers take over. The strong earthquake off the coast of Japan has been initially estimated at 7.9 on the Richter scale. At least one person has died and scores of people have been hurt. Most of the injuries are not serious. The BBC's Philip Short has this report.
The earthquake struck off the coast of Hokkaido, the northernmost Japanese island, a little before 10:30 local time, as people were going to bed. On land, roads cracked, and shops and homes were shaken violently by tremors which reached as far away as Tokyo, nearly 600 miles to the south. But the main fear was of tidal waves, and Japanese television immediately began broadcasting emergency warnings, urging people in coastal areas to leave their homes and seek safety on high ground. According to American monitoring stations, it's among the strongest ever to have hit Japan, yet apparently did much less damage than other less powerful tremors.
Philip Short reporting. President Clinton welcomed South African President Nelson Mandela to the White House today on his first state trip to Washington. Mandela is drumming up economic support for South Africa. He says his country needs it badly now that the era of apartheid is over. The Clinton administration has pledged $600 million in financial aid to South Africa, and President Clinton says the U.S. will be there to support South Africans.
We pledge, as you have pledged, that we will walk every mile with you, and that we will not grow weary on the way.
The White House has reportedly earmarked another $200 million in loan guarantees to build new housing in black townships. A national teachers union says teachers are making more money this year, but they aren't keeping up with inflation. The American Federation of Teachers has released a survey showing the average teacher's salary was about $35,000 this year. That's up 2.3% from last year. The union says states are spending less on salaries. They used to spend 53% of their educational budget on salaries in the mid-60s. Now, states spend an average of 39%. Teachers in Connecticut were the most well-paid at an average of $50,000. Teachers in Mississippi were the lowest paid at an average of $25,000. Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow fell more than 45 points. This is NPR News. The federal government has halted most of the nuclear weapons dismantling now taking place at the Oak Ridge Reservation in Tennessee after safety violations were uncovered. Kim Smith of member station WUOT reports.
The Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board found more than 1,100 safety violations at the Y-12 plant at the Oak Ridge Reservation. The inspectors found that highly enriched uranium, which is taken out of nuclear weapons and stored in vaults at the site, were packed too closely. Physicists say that could spark a nuclear chain reaction and result in a deadly shower of radiation and heat. Ralph Hutchinson is coordinator of the Oak Ridge Peace Alliance.
While they may have had a good plan on paper, clearly, in more than 1,000 instances, they were not following the plan that they had on paper.
DOE officials say the violations, while serious, pose no immediate threat. The 1,300 workers at Y-12 are undergoing additional training to correct the violations cited in the report. For National Public Radio, I'm Kim Smith in Knoxville.
The Mediterranean fruit fly has been discovered in the cropland of Ventura County, California. Medflies can destroy lemons, strawberries, and other fruits, and an infestation could destroy the county's crops. 33 medflies have been found in the past several days. Authorities have banned growers from shipping their produce until quarantine lines are set up. A spokesman for the Cooperative Medfly Project says that is not intended to put Ventura County growers out of business. He says it's to protect California. Authorities are now ground spraying malathion, a pesticide. Pro-communist demonstrators erected a human chain around the Russian White House today in Moscow. The building is the headquarters of the Russian government led by President Boris Yeltsin. It also used to house the Russian parliament until a year ago today. That's when a rebellion against Yeltsin was put down with army tanks and artillery that fired on the building. More than 140 people died over 4 days of fighting. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Peter Guralnick, the author of a new book about the young Elvis Presley called Last Train to Memphis. It's the first part of Guralnick's projected two-volume biography of Elvis. Sam Phillips launched Elvis's career at Sun Records, and then Colonel Tom Parker, seeing the commercial potential in Elvis, took over the management of his career. Colonel Tom Parker got Elvis into the movies, where I guess Elvis was interested in being. I mean, he'd wanted to be in the movies, didn't he?
Yeah, he said from the very beginning of his career, he used to tell Tom and Helen Neal that was his ambition. He would, driving back from those early gigs down in Mississippi and Arkansas, Bob Neal would be asleep in the back seat, and he would be telling Helen Neal that was what he was going to be. He was going to be a movie star.
But you say he wanted to be a serious actor. He wanted to be like Brando or Dean. And he was in a couple of serious films and a couple of really good musicals, but a lot of the movies he made are just, you know, unfortunately really kind of silly. Does Tom Parker take the blame for the tackier Elvis vehicles?
Well, I think financial success takes the blame, and the lack of any artistic direction to either counter or block the financial direction of his career. This really isn't applicable to the movies that he made before he went into the Army. At least I don't think so. If you look at each of those four movies, each of them represented a widening of opportunity, a broadening of acting possibilities. And I'm not suggesting that any of them is a masterpiece per se, or that Elvis achieved all of his ambitions in them. But if you look at King Creole, say, as opposed to Love Me, he went into Love Me Tender without any acting experience whatsoever, and you can see him trying to put the emotion out there on the screen, the emotion that the expressiveness that he admired in Brando or Dean or Montgomery Clift or Richard Widmark. You can see him trying to explode, in a sense, in the same way that he did on stage, and you can see him succeeding on occasion. By the time he made King Creole 2 years later, he's actually, by the time he made King Creole a year and a half later, you can see a great deal more technique. You can see the same intensity of feeling, and you can see him really reaching for a much more ambitious kind of role. So each of the movies that he made before going into the Army was a step up, and I think in that sense, that's one of the ways that I tried to look at things as they developed at the time. If you were to predict Elvis's movie career after he'd completed King Creole, I think that I'm not saying that the average. He was obviously a teenage phenomenon. Also, I mean, he was a marketing phenomenon as well. But Hal Wallace was expecting Elvis to have a career. Hal Wallace was not only expecting Elvis to have a career similar to Bing Crosby or some of the other longer running Hollywood stars. He saw Elvis as having the dramatic potential and capability of an actor like Brando.
In your biography, you show Elvis in his early years to be, you know, a reasonably shy person. And then once his career starts to take off, I mean, he's so magnetic on stage. And, of course, he becomes famous for the, quote, swiveling hips. How did he develop that stage presence? What were you able to learn about how he got such a physical sense of himself on stage?
He had never set foot on stage before the first show that he did in Memphis. At least not in a professional way. He had appeared in a high school talent contest. When he appeared at Overton Park on July 30th, 1954, he, according to Elvis, according to Scotty, according to Sam Phillips, and according to Bob Neal, who, and I don't know who would know better than they, he was scared to death, and he got out there on stage. And part of his nervousness was expressed in the way he jiggled his leg, and he was wearing these oversized kind of pantaloons almost, you know, very broad. As Scotty said, it looked like all hell was breaking loose under there. The response that he got that day evidently was the spur to what became known as his act. But the thing that you've got to remember about Elvis is that he was a great mimic. You can listen to Elvis vocally, ape Hank Snow or Ernest Tubb or all kind, you know, or Dean Martin in a very convincing manner. And he was a very quick study. And as Bob Neal describes those early shows, and Scotty Moore does as well, he would go out there, he would try all kinds of things. The things that didn't work, he would discard immediately. The things that did work, he would work on, he would hone, and they would become part of the show instantly. So I think that's the way in which his showmanship evolved. The one other thing I think not to be lost sight of is that Elvis felt the most intense, almost physical satisfaction. He described it as just he couldn't imagine a greater feeling than the feeling of I don't know what you'd call it, electricity that he felt on stage.
My guest is Peter Guralnick, the author of Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Elvis Presley with Peter Guralnick, the author of a new biography. Your book ends with Elvis in the army, boarding the ship that's going to take him overseas to Germany. And there's a lot of press and fans and so on there. In fact, let me play a little bit of a press conference that I held right before he set sail.
Here at the Brooklyn POE, where Elvis Presley, Private Elvis Presley of the United States Army, is due to embark for Germany today. And let me tell you just a little of what the hubbub is like here. We've been, as I say, waiting for the past 2 hours for Presley to come in. There was some delay with his train. Now Elvis moves over and is going to sit down behind the desk. The microphones will be brought in. More pictures will be taken. Elvis apparently enjoying the whole thing very much. He's been in smiles since he walked into the room.
I'll starve to death, sir.
Is there a question back there?
I beg your pardon, sir.
What do you think you might do? Maybe we have that jumper.
If rock and roll music were to die out, which I don't think it will, I would try something else. I would really probably go in for the movies then. I would try to make it as an actor, which is very tough because you got a lot of competition.
Peter, would you describe to us a little bit about what that day was like for Elvis?
It's a perfect example of the dutiful Elvis carrying out his sense of behaving correctly in public while feeling utterly forlorn and lost inside. I think there was a sense on his part. His mother had just died. Here he was on display. He's feeling as if as he has told many of his close friends, he feels as if his career is gone at the moment of greatest triumph. The most terrible things have happened to him. And yet here he is on stage in front of all these people, all these adults, who really don't particularly wish him well, presenting a smiling, dutiful exterior image, saying all the things that he should say, never breaking his composure, never breaking, and expressing his patriotism and a sense of duty. It's a remarkable. It's not simply a remarkable performance. I mean, it expresses some of his very best qualities, and it also expresses some of the qualities which, in a sense, crippled him.
Which qualities do you think of the ones that crippled him?
The inability to let loose his emotions, to let loose emotions that he considered unworthy, I guess. The inability to express vulnerability, except to perhaps a girlfriend, almost always a woman, but rarely a man. The inability to show his either ignorance of a subject, I mean, as we're all ignorant of subjects, or his sense of uncertainty or loss.
Well, you have to now write the second half of Elvis's life. I'm wondering if in the first part of his life, the part you've just written about in Last Train to Memphis, if you begin to see Elvis being trapped by his celebrity, as he really became later on in his life.
Oh, I think you very much see it. But I think the thing you really see is a sense of abandonment almost. And I don't mean that in a self-pitying kind of a way. I think Elvis had a sort of totemic relationship with the people who had started out his career. And I don't think he was traumatized by his contract being sold to RCA. But when he saw the people who had helped him so much and in whom he had placed so much faith gradually drifting out of the sphere of his world, when he saw someone like Dewey Phillips falling into disgrace in Memphis and actually kind of messing up with Elvis himself, when he saw Marion Kiesker leaving Sun, when Scotty and Bill essentially went on strike and left, for hire and sought higher pay from him and just walked out in a public dispute. I think these were things that led him to question not so much his sense of himself as his sense of place. I mean, it undercut this sense that he was somehow or other, I think he saw himself almost as blessed. He saw himself as fortune's child, and really fortune advanced without a moment's hesitation for a very long time. And then around the summer of 57, all these things started happening, and then he was drafted, and then his mother died. And I don't mean to make too much of the symbolism, but what I think in Elvis's mind, and as he expressed it, it's almost as if he felt his luck was running out. And I think this was a terrible blow to his sense of security.
Do you think it's going to be more difficult for you to write about the second half of Elvis's life? Because that's a life in which he becomes kind of a victim of fame, where his music becomes more Vegas-y, where he becomes kind of too big to be human almost. Will it be more difficult for you to write about a side of him that I guess you might feel slightly less affectionate about?
I don't think I'd feel any less. I mean, it's the person that I feel the affection for, not the side. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, friends who do things which, you know, you may not like or you may not approve of. If you like the person, you don't throw them out for their vagaries. It presents a real challenge because so much of Elvis's life was lived behind closed doors after he got out of the army. I mean, the thing that's astonishing in a way is how open Elvis was both in the life that he led and in his expressions about that life prior to going into the army. And that's just perhaps an accident of the times. When he got out of the army, he lived almost entirely whatever took place in private. And I think in that sense, it presents a challenge in terms of creating a convincing narrative. And it also does in the sense that a great deal of it simply doesn't matter as much. I mean, the fact that he's making movie number 17 or movie number 21, these are not movies which bear a great deal of analysis. What does bear analysis is what's happening with Elvis. So it will be a book with a different style. I mean, that's really why I had never intended to write two volumes, but I realized midway through writing the first that these were two different stories, and they were different stories not just in the type of story that they actually were, but actually in the approach that you had to take to them.
Is there a record of yours that you're particularly fond of that you'd like us to end with?
Trying to Get to You.
And why'd you choose that?
I've always felt like that has an almost spiritual quality. Actually, I think he could have done it better. I think that's one of the few examples. His contract with Sun was just about over, and I think that if he had stayed with Sun, I think Sam Phillips would have recorded it again, and they would have pushed it further and further. But I just think it has a depth and a feeling and a spirituality that's really remarkable.
Well, Peter Guralnick, thanks so much for talking with us about Elvis.
Thank you.
Peter Guralnick is the author of Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley.
I've been traveling over miles, even through the valleys too. I've been traveling in vain, I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Ever since I read your letter, where you said you loved me true, I've been traveling night and day, I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. When I read your loving letter, then my heart began to sing. There were many miles between us, but it didn't mean a thing. I just had to read you, baby, kept traveling night and day, I kept running all the way, baby, trying to get to you.
This is Fresh Air. One of the three most powerful men in Haiti has left the country. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that, on All Things Considered?
Michel Francois was a police chief and thought to be one of the coup plotters, Terry. We'll have a piece from Suni Khalid, who is still in Port-au-Prince. Also, President Aristide of Haiti speaks at the United Nations today. Nelson Mandela of South Africa is here in Washington. We'll have a piece on the Inkatha Freedom Party and the ANC. Paul Hill goes on trial in Pensacola today. He is on trial for shooting a doctor who performed abortions, and will have a piece on a judge in Rhode Island who hands out very tough sentences for gun crimes.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a problem we all have to face in radio when we have to pronounce a foreign word. Do we Americanize it or say it as the natives do? Linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on the difficulties of being phonetically correct.
I went into a bookstore. They had the radio on. The announcer was talking about the 11th hour agreement on Haiti. He said, "The agreement calls for the return of exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide." As soon as I heard that French R, I figured it had to be public radio, not one of those AM deals where you give them 10 minutes and they give you the world. Public radio announcers are the only ones who trouble themselves about being phonetically correct. There's that pronunciation of Spanish names that suggests a vague solidarity with the Latin peoples, like when reporters used to file their stories from Managua, Nicaragua. There's the way Daniel Schur used to talk about Mikhail Gorbachev, with the easy familiarity of an old Kremlin hand. I never know quite what to do when I have to say a foreign word on the radio. I feel as if I'm talking to two audiences, the one a couple of 100,000 American listeners, the other the ghost of Miss Hetzler, my ninth grade French teacher. It's a pretty even matchup. I certainly don't want to sound like those classical music DJs of the school of Milton Cross or the redoubtable Robert J. Lertzema out of WGBH in Boston. When it comes to foreign names, guys like this give no quarter. We heard the final act of the Otello of Giuseppe Verdi with Lubia Kazanovskaya and Placido Domingo, followed by the Liebestod from Richard Wagner's Götterdämmerung, sung by Kirsten Flogstad. They roll these names out of their mouths the way Vladimir Horowitz used to shoot octaves out of his shirt cuffs. But of course, they're trained professionals, and you shouldn't try this sort of thing in your own living room. The greater its success is a tour de force, the more it brings the conversation to a dead halt, with half your listeners lost in admiration, and the others just plain lost. Still, there isn't much glory in the Cuisinart approach to foreign pronunciations, where you puree all the sounds into an American AM mix. And I could sympathize with the announcer who allowed himself to say Aristide. That French R is hard to resist. It's the purest emblem of phonetic savoir-faire. And like every American who studies French, that announcer must have put heart and soul into acquiring the sound. It's a triumph that Alice Kaplan describes in her recent memoir, French Lessons, which is the story of an American woman's lifelong fascination with French language and culture. Kaplan recounts the moment when, as a student at a Swiss boarding school, she suddenly realized that she'd mastered the French R. "I opened my mouth and I opened up. It slid out, smooth and plush, a French R. It was a sound my cat makes when she wants to go out, between a purr and a meow, a gurgling deep in the throat. It was smooth and suave. I had it. With this R, I could speak French. I wouldn't be screaming my Americanness every time I spoke. R was my passport." I like this passage because it seems to me a miniature of every classic American tale of expatriation, liberation mixed with faint cultural treachery. And of course, when Kaplan returned home to finish high school in Minnesota, there were all the predictable letdowns that come with a story. She felt out of place in her French clothes. Her former boyfriend was embarrassed by her French manners and her French swimsuit. You can pick up all this stuff abroad, but you can't take it home with you, not to America. In the end, that's what tips the balance against phonetical correctness. You arrive at the airport, you leave your airs and your R's on the plane. Oh, Miss Hetzler, pardonnez-moi.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the true story of a virus so deadly, the U.S. military was called in to eradicate it. The story is as scary as any science fiction movie. We'll talk with journalist Richard Preston about his new book, The Hot Zone. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.